From WLVR Bethlehem and Lehigh University, this is the show that gets you behind the real lives of Lehigh faculty. This is Prof Talk.
Hi, welcome to another amazing episode of Prof Talk. Today we are here with Professor of Journalism, Jeremy Latow. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
That's a broad question. What would you like to know?
How long have you been teaching? Where'd you go to school, etc.?
Got professional stuff.
Yeah.
40 years old. I'm a former journalist who worked in the industry professionally for 8 years. I consider myself having been a journalist for at least 10 because I count college journalism. So I'm out of college in 97. And
which college?
Biola University. It's B-I-O-L-A.
B-I-O-L-A?
It's in La Mirada, California. Graduated communication major, journalism emphasis. Bounced around California, Nevada professionally for about 8 years as a professional. And my last newspaper was the Los Angeles Daily News. I went back to grad school in 2004 at the University of Missouri to get my master's. I originally had planned to retool in digital and then go back out and work, but with the idea that someday I'd want to teach, kind of been doing it as an adjunct for a few years. Kind of fell in love with being at school and decided I want to keep going. So I've got my PhD. I got my master's in 2007 and I finished my PhD in 2009.
Where?
Both of Mizzou. Yeah, both of Mizzou. And then came here. So I've been here since August 2009.
And where do you say you got your BA in communications?
Yeah, BA in communications.
When?
That was journalism track within the communication major, but
When did you say that was?
Graduated in 97.
And during that time when you were bouncing around the Los Angeles, Nevada area, what were you doing?
Started off, my first job was in 98 as a little paper outside Sacramento called the Daily Democrat. And I was a sports reporter. I was basically like a general assignment sports reporter for a small, it was 10,000 circulation daily. Although they only published 6 days, so I guess, I don't know if it was a daily, I guess it was. they call it a daily, but we didn't publish on Saturdays.
I mean, isn't the weekend the most important day for a paper, though?
Sundays are. Saturdays are actually pretty low circulation days, historically. It's one of the lighter days of the week. Sundays are really big, though.
So we didn't
publish on Saturdays.
I wouldn't expect you not to publish on Sunday. Like, that's easily the biggest day.
Yeah, it was a very strange setup. But I also was like the weekend editor, like roughly. Like on Saturday nights, I would kind of put out the section a lot of times, unless it was like a major sports season. During summers, I was the guy because it was a 2.5 person staff, and so the sports editor went on vacation. He would go. He was an older guy.
Two and a half staff.
Yeah. We had a half timer. He was like basically like a part time guy.
Okay.
And he basically was, his job was to take calls at night from coaches calling in scores and stuff like that. So he wasn't really doing any reporting really. So basically, when the editor went on vacation for like 6 weeks at a time in the summer, I was the sports editor for like a 6 week period, another 4 week period. So did that for about a year and change, like about a month after that, about 13 months. And then I got hired at over the Sierras in Carson City, Nevada at the Appeal. It was the Nevada Appeal. And they hired me to be their sports editor, which was a huge, insane jump I probably wasn't ready for. But I knew somebody there who had worked for my former boss. And there's like this, my first boss was, he was like this old, salty old journalist who had been, he'd worked for AP and, he'd been around and this was his hometown. So he'd come back to that. So there's kind of this like sense that like, if you'd worked for this guy and had survived, you were good. And basically I got that job on reputation alone pretty much. and I went from being a 2.5 person staffer. I was the general assignment reporter, being a sports editor in Carson City, managing a staff of two full-time reporters and then, half-time person, and then two people who basically put together our scoreboard page.
Yeah.
So I basically had a 5-person staff, which was a big change. That put me behind a desk for the first time. For the most part, I went out and did some reporting, but not a lot. I was more selective about it, and I got to pick stories that interested me rather than like assigned to. It was the assigner, and we were responsible for covering 4 different counties. So it was kind of an interesting change. And it was also Nevada for the first time in my life. Was there from February 1999 to, I guess, June of 2000, July. And then I
I went down to the Daily News. Again, got that job because the recruitment editor there had worked for my old boss at my first job. It had the same sensibility. If you survived, and you're good. So I actually interviewed for that job like in March of that year, and they set up there where they were trying to find people and invest in like cultivating them long term. Yeah. It wasn't 6 months later until they had a job opening for me. Actually, I took a job at the sports desk there. Started off just designing pages, but I was doing a lot of everything by the time I was done. I was designing entire sections, which, I mean, so like my first newspaper, if you were lucky, they had three pages inside. And then like my sports section in Nevada, we sometimes had up to six or eight on a Sunday, but I mean, we were daily in every sense of the word there. But Los Angeles, I was in the major metro for the first time. So, I mean, a small section for us was eight pages, and even bigger sheets. We had as many as 24 one day. When you're designing, sometimes you're designing that entire section. So like there were days I drew up the entire section. And like I had people paginating for me, but I was the lead designer across the entire section. There I started off as a designer, and then I did some copy editing and headline writing, and kind of got to know all the phases of the desk job. I did some reporting occasionally, but nothing really big. I got to do some cool stuff when I was there. We had a run of Los Angeles Lakers championship falls there. They won three titles in a row at one point. So I designed major front pages for championship game and special sections. I got to design the baseball section every year, like the preview edition they put out in April and stuff like that. So it was a really nice, fun, creative job for me. Mm-hmm. I should also, throughout this, I was doing digital work on the side. So I'm self-trained on digital up until my grad school experience. So I was doing a little, like before we were doing a lot of the internet, I was helping upload stories and that kind of stuff. But that was like by volunteer. It wasn't part of my job description. I just did it because it interested me. So I've always had a hook in digital, but it was never formed part of my jobs.
The Daily News, that's in Los Angeles, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And then what encouraged you to go to University of Missouri to get your master's and graduate school?
The industry was changing. I could feel it coming. The layoffs hadn't started yet, but they were. I knew they were. I logged on to Craigslist for the first time in 2003 and thought, oh my God, we're in trouble. Because an industry that had made 25% of its revenue from classified advertising, all of a sudden there was a site that was giving it away, and I knew we were screwed. We also were very, very heavily invested in print at a time when the internet was starting to expand. I didn't see social media coming back then, but I knew it existed. And I knew, it's just the ability to take whatever you wanted and republish it. I thought that digital skills were going to be more important. And, I hadn't been formally trained in it, and I didn't think I was qualified to move in those positions if the region started to restore itself. So I felt like I was like a layoff target because my skills were not considered digital, even though I was interested in doing some of it. So my original idea had been to go back to school to retool digital, like I said. So I ended up staying, but I mean, I knew I had to do that. I mean, I knew there was a wave coming. And it was funny. I started in August 2004 at Mizzou, and within a year, that was when like the layoffs started hitting in mass on the industry. Like my newsroom in LA had 160 people when they started there in 2000. By 2007, it was down to 60.
Oh my God!
It got decimated. And a lot of people who got laid off were, at first it was reporters, but then it was desk people. They started to centralize the desks across the chain, so that like all of a sudden California newspapers, that was part of a news group that had like eight newspapers there. They started to basically universalize the desks, so they were like taking copy editors from all the different papers and designers from all the papers and putting them all in one place, and they were designing for eight different newspapers, and so it meant less jobs. And so I'm not sure I would have been targeted, but I was one of the higher paid first people in the newsroom by the time I left, so at least on the desk, so I might have been a target. This cost of it. So it was strategic in a lot of ways, but like I said, I ended up going a different direction I thought I was going to go, but I at least knew that I needed do something different.
Mm-hmm. And so why University of Missouri?
Reputation, really. I didn't know what I was doing as far as grad school. Like I should have been smarter about it, done more homework about what they had. I didn't realize what grad school really was. And what they were good at, what the relative strengths and weaknesses are, and what you're looking for in master's if you think you want to go into a PhD. I had no clue about this stuff. I really fell into a good program by accident.
Yeah.
Um, I, and it was basically mostly on reputation. I mean, they were the first journalism school in the world, and you know, they churn out really good people. It turns out their reputation mostly is at the undergrad level, so I mean, I wasn't really necessarily going about it. They have a really great master's program for experience, but it was just kind of luck that I got to work with amazing people there, fall into mistakes that actually turn out working for you is probably a good way to say what happened there.
So how do you see the industry changing since you've mentioned that kind of there's this death of the newspaper going on?
Well, obviously there's the business model changes that I don't think anyone really knows exactly what's happening there yet. Although I think that we've seen some strides in that direction. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm broadly focused, I would say that journalists who are more in tune with what audiences want, and that can come in the realm of analytics or just like, you know, testing different versions mm-hmm. of stories and headlines, things like that, or just kind of producing content that's based on you know, what audiences actually told us they want, rather just like a gut feeling, which we always did. I think they're being more successful. I think we have to be more social and more engaged. I think we have to be more integrated in local community than we used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the days of like, you know, major regional metros. And like my neighbor in LA, like covering national stories and making front page stories. I mean, those are the ones that are really suffering. It's the ones that have gone intensely local because that's the niche. I mean, it's like, you know, daily news trying to compete on the internet with everybody on a national story isn't working anymore. The internet's blown that away. But they do own the local story. Like, nobody else can cover a local story like they can because they have the resources of the people on the ground. That, you know, we had to be much more engaged with that. But I think also it requires a different skill set. I mean, one of the stories I always tell people is when I was in college, we had basically four ways to tell a story: print, radio, television, and online, if you wanted to count that. Okay. If we saw that's a different thing. And now, I mean, I can probably imagine 40, 50, 60 ways to tell a story. You know, given a particular scenario, not all work, but, you know, multimedia has opened up a whole vaster variety of things, ways we can do things. I mean, journalists need to be a lot more generalist. Like, I trained to become a writer when I was in college, and I worry about any journalism student who just wants to be a writer because, like, the world is demanding so much more from you than just that.
Yeah.
And it's a basic core skill that's still really, really important. But, like, okay, what kind of writing? You know, writing for stories? What about live tweeting? Can you live tweet? Can you live blog? You know, can you write for the web only? Can you write headlines? You know, can you package stuff on, you know, probably really, really snappy narrative for like Snapchat or, you know, like for social referrals, things like that. So, I mean, the skill set that's demanded of today's students are much more broad than anything else. I was looking at something, it was a night report a couple of days ago that was looking at the core skills that are being demanded of journalists, and two of the top four were analytics and coding. I mean, like,
yeah.
I mean, none of those, they didn't even exist when I was in college. I mean, and really when I was at the Daily News, coding kind of existed.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't using too much of it. It was mostly HTML, but we were using a little bit of it, but the database usage wasn't that high. So, you know, the critical skill set that's being asked of students today is so much different than what it was when I was in the industry that, you know, it's important to, I guess it's important to see that the journalists are being asked to have a lot more general, like, jack-of-all-trades kind of skills than they used to.
You are listening to Prof Talks, only on WLVR Bethlehem, 91.3 FM. So, as a journalist going into the field today, well, as a college student acting as a journalist going into the field today, what skills would you recommend that I learn right now so I can get ahead in my field?
Well, I still think you're right now, I mean, you're in the vein of learning writing. I think that's the most important skill because it's core to everything. I think writing teaches you, like the basic reporting class you're in right now, teaches you basic information gathering skills that go across forms, like whether you want to be a multimedia journalist or a radio, you know, just pure print or radio or whatever, you still need to be able to, like, how to research, how to interview, how to talk to people, how to think about what is a story and what's not a story, you know, and how to express that in some way. And writing is a really good entry point for all that stuff. So I think where you're at right now is exactly where, you know, you need to be. But, you know, long term, I think that I tell students, you know, you need to figure out how to listen to audiences online and not, like, really listen to them, not just engage them, but listen to them, hear what they're saying, hear what they want. I think some basic social media skills are probably like the thing I would attach to the next level. Some visual skills I think are really important, you know, just in terms of like photography, videography, data visualization. If you can like learn how to present and package information in ways other than just writing, are probably next level versions of that. I think beyond that, you know, from there you figure out whether you want to specialize or you want to still be generalist. If you want to be generalist, add some coding skills to it. But you know, if you still want to make writing your core skill, that's fine. Just, you know, you have to learn how to think in multimedia. You have to learn how to tell a story in writing, but be able to attach other pieces to it. And some of that's about the storytelling skills themselves, like being able to do a good photo or do a video. But truthfully, you also need to be able to see that before you capture it. Like, you know, like to be, when you're starting a story, it's like, you know what, there's some really good photo opportunity here, or good visual opportunity for data visualization or something like that. And that's the harder part, like is being able to, like when you're approaching a story, to be able to imagine the different parts of it before you actually go gather that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even if you just want to be a pure writer, you know, I think you'd have to learn that basic sense of like the information gathering stage, the thinking stage, you know, how many ways can I tell the story and what are the most effective ways to do it? That's the kind of question I want my students asking throughout their 4 years here, you know, and they should theoretically be adding to their toolkit every semester, you know, and ultimately you should be practicing a lot, you know, like every opportunity you get, you should be practicing the ability to do more than just write. I don't want students to take like multimedia with me, for example, and just like treat that as a one-off, like, okay, I'm good at social media now, because you're not. I mean, I'm still learning things about it, you know, and so it comes from using it every day. Using it professionally with a purpose, you know, and I think the same goes for pretty much any of these forms. You got to practice as much as you can. My saddest thing that happens sometimes is when students come to me in their last semester and they want me to teach them social media. Like, okay, well, I'm willing to invest it. I mean, I'm a teacher. It's what I do. But yeah. Just so you know, like this is the wrong time to be asking me. Like you're basically trying to cram like into a semester skills that you could have basically spent 2 or 3 years practicing. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be totally noticeable, by the way, when someone goes to your Twitter feed and compares it to a student who's been doing it for 2 or 3 years. It's like, there's this whole sense of like literacy and accessibility, and like I can tell when someone knows what they're doing, you know, and it's you can't fake that. So I practice.
Which platforms do you think are the main forms of social media?
Depends on what we're talking about, but like just in terms of audience engagement and listening, Twitter is probably my go-to one. I think if you construct your people you follow correctly, you know, you will be able to figure out what people are saying and talking about. That, you know, it's useful. ideally, like a professional journalist should be listening to their audience, which means they should be following people from the local community. You know? And hearing what they're talking about, and you get story ideas out of that. But you also get feedback on stories you produced, and you know, we should be listening to that because they have sometimes stupid things to say, but sometimes they have relevant, useful things to say, and we can learn a lot from them. So that's a go-to listening tool, but also kind of a pushing tool. Like I there's a lot of link sharing going on. I think it's useful, but I think there's a limited value to that. I think that journalists let me become good information sharers doesn't necessarily have to do with just sharing your own publications links or your own stories. You know, I think we have to be able to share useful things even if we didn't make them. The big one I see coming, there's two. Periscope is going to be huge. I think it already is to some degree, but live streaming video is really important. It's going to be the thing that probably destroys television.
Live stream
video.
Radio?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to think about television's leverage, it's what we call it, in economic terms, we call it its competitive advantage, which is that it was really hard to broadcast live video, right? We had to have expensive satellite trucks and satellites and, you know, towers to send the stuff out. And now anybody with a phone can just broadcast from anywhere they are, Trump rally, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that live eyewitness thing that was always part of the television model and really is the one thing that they do different than any other form of media, that's gone. So now it expands up to the quality of reporting, which, by the way, they steal most of it from the newspaper. So, like their story ideas and stuff like that is coming from what people are already producing. So their competitive advantage is going to get blown away as this technology improves. And so, like, the ability for anybody to become a television reporter in the moment, should they so choose, is huge. You know, like, you think about, like, what stands for campaign coverage right now is basically CNN setting up shop at, like, a Bernie Sanders rally and turning on a camera and, like, broadcasting it. Well, I can just log on to Periscope and get that. That's not hard. You know, what used to be difficult now is easy.
Yeah.
So Periscope's one. I think that the message space is the other piece. Snapchat is a good example of that, but I think there are others, like WhatsApp. And the ability to share things kind of in conversational ways. I was sitting on a really interesting conference a couple weeks ago that was talking about how people are creating bots that live within these chat apps to, like, interact with people.
Yeah.
And, you know, that there's a conversational kind of programming and writing that's really interesting there. This is not a fleshed out space by any stretch, but I think it somewhat represents the future, partially because the generation that's coming up behind you guys, Generation Z, is very, very much into the messaging space, which means it's a huge delivery system, but also an engagement tool in this group. So I think that messaging apps offer some extra layer of things that we should be in. So yeah, video, I think video and messaging, I think, are probably two big areas that are probably to differing degrees. I think they're still an evolving future for us. I think the future of live streaming videos now, you know, you take like Periscope and throw it on a drone, you know, I mean, yeah. Like, you know, it's just, I can do stuff with that, like, right now. So I think, you know, the big takeaway, though, is beyond individual apps, we need to be playing all the time. Like, we need to be trying new things. And even if it's technology that's still kind of in its formative stages, we need to be in the spaces now and inventing that before somebody invents that storytelling form and steals it from us, which is what happened basically in the internet in the 2000s. And it's just like the first decade was lost because news organizations sat around on their high circulation numbers and expected that they would always be around. And then, like, some people came out and just stole their lunch, you know, and it's imperative that news organizations are the ones creating the new storytelling forms if they want to survive. And journalists are a big part of that.
So let's say if I wanted to be a TV executive for a major network television, would you recommend me to not do that? Because will we see a death in the big, like, cable corporations?
What kind of executive running what entertainment side?
Yeah, just TV shows.
I think the future of TV is going to be so crazy different by the time, you know, maybe not when you first get out, but, you know, I mean, look how much TV has changed in the last 4 years here. Mm-hmm. I mean, 4 years ago, most people were either watching television from, like, cable or satellite over the air, and Netflix DVDs that got sent to them in the mail, right? And that was television. And now, satellite's losing subscribers, cable's losing subscribers, over-the-air television, just a small audience, if not smaller than it used to be.
Oh, yeah.
And DVD subscription, Redbox, dying. But what's replaced it is Netflix. Streaming video, right? Like, Netflix went to the streaming model, but now you got streaming that's available from Amazon, Netflix, Hulu. You know, you can subscribe individually to over-the-top services like HBO, Showtime, things like that. And we're seeing more and more companies. ESPN's talking about doing that sometime in the next couple of years. You know, the delivery method is increasingly moving, like, not just online, but, like, direct to consumer, where I can, like, say, ESPN, I want you. I don't want to go through DirecTV to get you. I want to just buy access to you.
Yeah.
You know, so that has changed the game a lot because, A, it's cut out some of the middlemen who are doing delivery. But the other piece of this is it's also enabled new players. So, like, Netflix as a company didn't exist 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, Hulu didn't exist until some of the major TV networks went together and created Amazon, of all people. Like, Amazon was a book dealer when they first launched, and now they're making original TV shows. Apple's talking about dabbling in the space. So, like, Google's going to be playing here. And some non-traditional broadcast companies are coming up, and they're competing with these people. And so I see it very, very similar to what happened with newspapers when blogs started to create independent publications.
Mm-hmm.
You know, TV is going to be continually challenged. I mean, I was a TV executive right now. I'd be losing sleep over Netflix because they're investing millions of dollars in original programming. And right now, TV and movie studios have been making pretty good money from like what we call distribution fees, where somebody's Netflix is basically renting someone's entire catalog so they can stream like movies and stuff to people. Mm-hmm. What happens when Netflix doesn't need to do anymore because they have such interesting programming they're producing on their own, they don't need to do that? You know, where are they getting their money from then? So I, you know, like ABC used to have to worry about CBS, CW, NBC, and ABC, or you had your big four, right?
Yeah.
And now you got to worry about Netflix, Amazon, Hulu. It's a much bigger game. And one of the things we know about like a world where like information and entertainment becomes more abundant is that what is happening is traditional business models get destroyed. So I would say if you want to be a TV executive someday, you need to reimagine what that's going to look like, because you may not even be talking about television. You may be talking about people watching on tablets and computers. Like the television set in itself may not, it doesn't offer the same kind of opportunity that like it offered when I got out of college, mm-hmm. you know, where like television was delivered to you by a cable or a satellite. So I think that probably the networks, I mean, the television companies are the people who have to think about less about the content and more about how you're going to reach people. And I think that's a real big challenge because the networks themselves are behind. And if I was going to work in television right now, I would want to work for Netflix. Because they've figured out a lot of things. And it's not just the streaming part of it. They've also figured out how to mine the data that their audience delivers every time they select something to watch. They've figured out how to turn that into making programming decisions. So, you know, like they, for example, they know you like to watch Daredevil. You
know? I love Daredevil. That's not fair.
It's a great show, right? Yeah. But like one of the things they learned from that show is that people who watch that show also like to watch certain other types of shows.
Yeah.
And so when they're figuring out how to invest their dollars, they know they can smartly invest in other types of stories that like that audience is going to like,
because
they have analytics on them. Right. TV companies have not traditionally made decisions like that. They basically said, who's tuning in? Okay, well, we'll fund that show. And that's a really, really blunt model.
Yeah.
Like in terms of like, it's terrible.
The Nielsen ratings.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's a terrible model in some ways. Cause like some of that was always dependent on, are people around on Friday nights to watch television? Like
pretty much. Yeah.
It doesn't mean that they didn't like the show or liked the show. They may have been watching cause there was nothing else on. Mm-hmm. Or they would have liked to watch the show. It was on the wrong day. I mean, there was almost no way of doing it. Television, but Netflix not only disrupted the way we take audience analytics and decide to make programming decisions, but they also disrupted the notion of like, you have to tune in at a certain time to watch a show. You can just binge whenever you want. You know, if you want this content, we will give it to you whenever you want. Mm-hmm. TV's really behind on that. And there's a lot of traditional pressures in place that are keeping them from innovating. Like I would look at that objectively and say, well, why won't you just change? Well, because there's a lot of money wrapped up in the old way still. And they're doing the same problem the newspapers had, which is at what point do we disinvest from this model that's making us a lot of money and put the future of ourselves on the line to invest in a new way of doing things? You know, so like TV's making huge amounts of money from like carriage fees on DirecTV and cable. And to disrupt that model with like a binge method, like if ABC did that tomorrow,
which I doubt,
you'd be basically taking a huge short-term hit. To create a long-term business. Netflix has the advantage of like, they don't care. They're new. Like they don't have any kind of like legacy investment in the old way. And that's what's weighing down some of the big companies right now, is that they may be in that moment newspapers were about 2003, which is like trying to ride this out as long as we can. And then by the time you get to the point where you're ready to pull the trigger on changing, it's too late. You know, and that's what's happening with newspapers right now. I think TV is a burning platform.
Burning platform.
Yeah, it's a model. I think newspapers have a much better chance of surviving the transition than television does.
That's saying a lot because newspapers are not faring well.
Right, right. I think television is infinitely more screwed because they have much less incentive to change until it gets really awful, and the costs are so high to make that change that they really should be doing it now. They need to be making those investments now, and they're often not. So I think the future of television is not in the networks that are like, so like ABC doesn't really create any content. Like they basically pay people to make content available for them to broadcast. Okay. And at some point those content creators are going to be like, screw you. We're just going to distribute this stuff direct to consumer ourselves. You know, we don't need you. And So like ABC as a company may not exist, you know, because they just there's no need for them. Like people have proven that we can just stream directly to people who want the stuff that they want and just upload it all to iTunes, get people to pay $20 or something like that. You know, they're in trouble. they're in big trouble.
What about radio? Is radio screwed also, or
radio's tough. Radio has been undergoing a slow decline for a while. Radio is a more interesting one because it requires less cost to get into the market as a listener and a consumer, and it's really, really big in certain parts of the country and in the world. Like in third world countries, radio is basically their entire lifeline to the outside world. So I think the radio question, I think, depends on a global context. In some cases, a local context, because, like, you know, in certain rural areas of America, you cannot get TV signal or your good TV signal. So radio is what you got. Mm-hmm. You also can't get really good internet signal. So, like, things like internet radio, podcasting, things like that, not as available to you. But the only thing you have really at that point is satellite. Mm-hmm. But satellite's a pay-for model. So, you know, radio... I think that, you know, they're undergoing a slow decline just in terms of loss of audiences, but I think we're probably going to see less stations, but it's still a low-cost entry to the point where I think it's still kind of a useful model. I think at some point it becomes unprofitable for a lot of these companies to stay in it. The big problem with radio is that a lot of the companies that own, like, there was a huge amount of consolidation in the 90s and the early part of the last decade, mm-hmm. and so they formed these mega conglomerates that are suffering under crushing debt load, and so... In gobbling up all these stations, they took on huge amounts of debt, and they can't afford to pay those bills anymore with declining audience and declining ad revenue. So it's not that radio isn't profitable anymore, it's that they're heavily under-leveraged. And so we'll probably see some bankruptcies, probably some stations going dark because of that. But I think that less players in the field of radio could actually be a good thing for the industry as a whole. Will it eventually lose its, you know, audience? Yeah, probably, you know, but they're not facing the same kind of problems TV is, because TV is so, has been so wildly successful and still where a lot of advertising dollars goes. I think they're kind of drunk on their own success at this point, and they don't see a lot of the big problems coming, like the big changes they need to make. Radio's been making them, you know, and stemming their decline. I think that, you know, a lot of the good ones are figuring out how to transition online anyway. And they may preserve themselves out.
You are listening to Prof Talks only on WLVR Bethlehem, 91.3 FM. I mean, my thought is that because you have major players like Apple and Spotify just choosing music whenever you can, whenever you want. And so why print on the radio when you just plug into your Spotify and be like, okay, here's my playlist. This is what I want to hear.
Yeah, I probably agree with that, except for radio has a lot more going on than that. Like, I have talk radio. It's sports streaming isn't really a thing yet for radio, for audio. So, like, you know, you want to tune into a Phillies game every night, for example. You know, there's really no other place to do that except for radio. So there's certain niche markets that I think are still some – you can't find what they're doing online. Like, how would you imagine talk radio on Spotify? Like, you couldn't do it. Like, it would require you know, a pretty big investment in live streaming audio.
Yeah,
and we don't really have, like, the app technology out there now. If I was out there a radio station, I'd try to invent that. I mean, it does exist, but it's really clunky. It's not great.
Live stream talk shows.
Yeah, like live streaming, like, over the internet. Again, you still need internet for it, but. You know, can we real cast things? And we have the ability to do this, but the technology hasn't been good, mostly because there hasn't been any money in it. So, like, think about, like, a podcast that was launched.
Yeah.
You know,
but, like, the thing is, most of it is, like, they're messing up and they have to edit it.
Right.
With talk shows. Yeah. So that's a major part of that.
Right. But it's still, yeah. I mean, like that happens in, it's basically the concept of live radio just in podcast form, right? Like, it would be no editing on the back end.
Yeah.
There hasn't been a lot of incentive to create this kind of technology because nobody's really wanted it. So there are some things you can't duplicate. Now, I think the one thing that could change that equation is if you know, they basically decided to create, like, an iTunes subscription to, like, sports games. You know, mm-hmm. That could change that, because it takes a huge chunk of revenue out of the system. But until that day comes, and the leagues have no incentive to do that again, because why would they? I mean, it's a golden goose for them. Mm-hmm. Don't mess with it; it's broken. But that day will come, probably when we get our act together on television. But it's until then, you know, it's I think radio's decline will be much more slow. But I don't think there's as many people actually incentivized to come in and break that system like there is television. Like, there's a huge amount of money to be had coming in breaking television, and so you have companies like Google and Amazon and Apple who are thinking about doing it because they can, you know, there's a lot more money to be made doing that.
So when do you see the death of television happening?
Well, television as we know it, like, yeah, just as a broadcast, yeah, model. I would be surprised if we got to 2030 and we still had over-the-air broadcast TV. Be shocked.
I'll take that bet. I'll remember this. I'll make a note in my calendar.
I would be shocked. I mean, 2 years ago, they were saying we would never have cord cutting. We would never have a la carte channels, and now we've got them. And we don't have a lot of them, but it just takes an HBO and then now a CBS to enter the space. And the big domino that falls is ESPN. I mean, most people only subscribe to cable because they don't like sports. Mm-hmm. So ESPN goes away. Like, if I don't have to subscribe to DirecTV or my local cable company to get sports, where I can buy, like, ESPN and then the NFL offers me games a la carte, mm-hmm, what's my incentive at that point? You know, yeah, huge amount of TV revenue comes from satellite cable. So the big domino is ESPN. Whenever ESPN makes that move, now that will basically be like game over. But that's the kind of thing where television starts to enter a death spiral, because all of a sudden now, right now, okay, if I want ESPN through a traditional method like cable or DirecTV, I have to pay a cable company for a package that includes ESPN, right? Mm-hmm. Well, included in that package is like my local channels, right? And so the local channels get a cut of that cable subscription every time I do that for just getting ESPN. Now I say, you know what? I want to get my money to ESPN directly. So I do that.
Yeah.
Local channels lose that revenue because my money's going directly to ESPN at that point, even if I'm paying way more than I should be. And so that's money out of their pockets. And there's no real way for them to make that up. So what will probably happen first is the death of the distributor, the cable company, who will transition to basically being a cable internet provider and then jack up the rates of cable internet to make up for the loss of the television revenue. But they will not be sharing any of that money with the local TV stations. So I think local TV is the first to go. I think that's the end of television and we know it, because then we're not talking anymore about jacking into a signal on like cable or satellite, or we're not talking about big networks anymore. I mean, it'll still exist. When I say 2030, I'm not talking about all gone. Like, some people will still, like, in a major market like Philadelphia or New York, okay, I can see it, but like, where's your incentive in the middle of Idaho to broadcast expensive television when someone can just get it through their internet? You know, I mean, there isn't any. It's not, it's just, you know, it's one of those things that just becomes wildly unprofitable. The other thing is the technology, even if you could make some money over the air, technology is changing stuff to the point where people can skip advertising. Well, that's where they're getting all their money from. Like, especially over the air, like, you're depending on advertising. And, you know, why would I want to sit there and, like, say, I have to be in front of my television at Thursday at 8 p.m. to watch my favorite show, when I can just get it on iTunes the next day and watch whenever I want? You know, it's just not, you know, again, those are, what ends up happening is that becomes a sinking ship, and then the people who've been selling their content to these networks to air, you know, like somebody creates like a popular TV show, like, it's a popular TV show. Like something that's on broadcast.
Big Bang Theory. Right?
Yeah, Big Bang Theory. Something like that.
Hate that show.
Like,
so much.
Okay, so like that show is distributed by CBS, right? Yeah. CBS doesn't make that show. They're buying the rights to that show from the studio that makes it. Yeah. So like, when the Big Bang Theory realizes they can make more money selling directly to consumers, what's CBS's value proposition?
Nothing.
So losing audience, losing ad dollars, and losing the one linkage they had to original programming at that point. They become like public access.
Doesn't CBS like provide the funding so they can actually create the show?
Yeah, but Netflix is playing in that space now. Apple's playing in that space. Google's playing in that space. Someone with venture capital is going to come along and play in that space, right? And like, they'll invent some better way to stream it than CBS has it delivering through the air.
So you're saying essentially Chuck Lorre can say, I'm going to fund this show. I'm going to give it right to you. Just pay me $5.
Yeah, create some distribution model myself. I get 100% of those dollars versus having to split it with a cable company. I don't know where you lose. I mean, it's you have to have a hell of a lot of money to start up and do
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But there are people with a lot of money out there to blow, and they will figure this thing out. So, you know, at this point, television's only model has been that they're a middleman for distributing content. And once that's done, once people figure out they can like go with an Apple TV box or a Roku box or
Google Chromecast, that's what I use.
Yeah, something like that. Then you basically substitute Chromecast for ABC.
Yeah.
Right? So what's ABC's value to you at that point? So no. when I say they're gone by 2030, that's what I'm talking about. It's like I think this is a trend that's going to accelerate, especially as more channels leave on the battery. I haven't had a subscription to cable or satellite in 5 years now.
Hmm.
And I was an early adopter. I use Apple TV.
Okay.
I was an early adopter of it, but I mean the technology is better than it used to be. The choices are better than it used to be. I haven't looked back. I paid Major League Baseball directly for my games. You know, when I want to watch a baseball game, I pay them $130 a year, and I have access to whatever I want. You know, it's going to work that way with a lot of different channels. We kind of subscribe when we want something, and when Game of Thrones is on, I subscribe to HBO. And in 10 weeks, I'll cancel the subscription for another 6 months until my show's coming out. And I'm not paying a dime to DirecTV.
Yeah.
I'm paying a dime to streaming companies, or I'm sorry, to cable companies, which means networks aren't getting my money. As more people start to adopt that habit, they're going to have to either, if they do survive in 2030, they're going to have to wildly reinvent themselves to stay there. And that means they won't be broadcasting anymore. They'll be doing something else. It'll probably become content studios themselves. You know, it's like ABC will become like a Netflix. Now, they could survive that, but that's fundamentally different than what television is right now. So when I say television will be dead by then, that's what I mean. It won't look anything like anything now that survives.
Right. How do you think social media has changed up the news game?
You have to be a really good at reporting in real time, unlike news to be. I think the danger of getting things wrong is not only more immediate, but it's also more damage is much more widespread than it used to be. But at the same time, I think, you know, it's a required skill. I mean, it's just something you have to be able to report in real time. You have to be able to gather information in real time, like learning how to listen to audiences, find information you need to get facts, are all really important things to have. I think social is basically plug journalists into their audience. You know, like they've been able to get real time feedback from audiences in ways they haven't before. And that has good and bad side effects, but it makes journalists actually have to listen to people, you know, rather than be experts, they can be guides. And they use that term a lot to describe the journalists we know. They're guides. They're not the people who tell you what's going on. They are there to help people find what's going on. Sometimes they can report that, and sometimes it's just pointing to the right person, you know. And there's a big loss of authority that comes in that, but I think it's a good, healthy thing for us in a lot of ways, because I think it's something freeing about not being an expert, you know, like not being have to say, I know everything. I know exactly what's going on. Like being able to say, here's what we know, here's what we don't know. It introduces uncertainty in the reporting equation, and I think that's a good thing for us, because I think for too long we've said, we know everything, you know, and when we're wrong, it's like, so yeah, I think it's kind of changed like our position with the public, our sense of what's important. I think it's taken away the value of being first, you know, like having the scoop, which I think is really good. Because maybe it's going to teach us to slow the hell down before we actually report stuff. You know, make sure we're correct. Like having a scoop isn't worth anything anymore, I think, because someone's going to have it before you on social media.
Time is always a factor, of course.
Somewhat, but it's like, especially in breaking news situation, it's better to be right than be first. I really do believe that, because like it's huge egg on your face when you're wrong. People will remember you being wrong more than they will if they do it first. It didn't used to be that way, but it definitely that's. Like you didn't come up through the industry when I was in first coming out, like having a scoop was a huge deal. It's just not that way anymore, you know. And half the time, even if you do scoop it, other people report it as breaking as if they're the ones who broke the story, because they know that none of this plugged into everyone anyway. So like giving you credit is not going to happen either, like it used to. So,
I spoke to Austin before, and he mentioned that in your class you used sensory journalism. What is that?
Oh, he's talking about my sensory journalism independent study group that we did this last. We're doing this right now.
Yeah, what is that?
We build a bunch of
I might have to.
So we're building bombs.
Bombs?
They look like bombs. These are little build-it-yourself computers.
Mm-hmm.
And this one measures temperature. So this is a little temperature sensor right there.
You are listening to Prof Talks, only on WLVR Bethlehem, 91.3 FM.
These are really flexible devices because basically it consists of a motherboard and SD card. And then you can plug other things into it, like Wi-Fi, sensors that measure things like sound and that kind of stuff. Well, we decided to do a project this semester. I saw that some news organizations were playing with sensor technology, so I was like, hey, let's try it. Didn't know anything about this at all. I had to learn on the fly with them. But I recruited a team of 6 students to basically say, you want to investigate this and see what comes of it. Yeah, so we did. We've had some interesting times. Like, we got these working in and they stopped working. and we haven't figured that part of it out yet.
I mean, probably because you don't have a case for it or anything. It's just jiggling around in your bag.
I don't think that's what's going on with it. I think that a bunch of them broke at the same time. We think maybe the components themselves may have gone bad on us. But
our charger stopped working yesterday.
Yeah, so anyway, I mean, but to me, if these things working or not, I don't really care. We were doing a storytelling project on the temperature of different places in the Linderman Library. You know, it's like what's the hottest and the coldest places to study and that kind of stuff. Real simple things, but it's student-driven inquiry. That's an independent study there. I had like 6 students participate in, and I'm letting them drive the bus on that. Like, I have some ideas and I'm a guide, but I'm not formally teaching because I'm not an expert in this. And he's part of that team. It's good.
What do you hope to accomplish through sensory journalism?
Mostly to figure out what's going on. This is more open-ended. Like, I don't know. And I'm okay with that. This is a trend. I want to know how it works. I want to know what we don't know. Like, what's most interesting to me about this is, like, you know, with the stuff breaking, for example, that shows me the holes in my game. And like if we were going to do this project again, which we will at some point, you know, like what we need to do to improve on that process. Okay, I need to recruit some technical experts, you know, and I've started looking around on that. You know, like what do I need to do to make that experience better the second time? You know, and part of this sometimes is about, like, you have to try stuff and let it break, and you need to fail a lot before you figure out what you don't know and what you need to kind of add to your knowledge. So my ultimate goal is to actually experience as much failure as success, and because I think you learn a lot from it. I'm not saying failure in the final sense or like you're a failure. It's more about, like, what did we not succeed at, and like what can we learn from that? To me, the questions there are just as interesting as what did I do well. In fact, I think in some cases they're more interesting because success is sometimes just a product of practice and experience. You know, like, you can be really bad at something, but if you try it enough, you'll figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But what ends up happening, I think, especially as we get older, is we stop challenging ourselves and we stop trying to investigate other things we don't know. And I'm trying, hopefully, with them to teach them a model of you need to be failing a lot. Like, you need to be figuring out what you don't know and learning how to learn. Because, like, once you get out of here, you don't have a teacher or a professor anymore to guide you on that. You have to figure out how to fail yourself, you know, and figure out how to investigate things you want to know and teach yourself new things. And I think that's what a lot of college is about, to be honest. So part of this has been about that, even if they don't realize it right now.
And what do you hope to accomplish within your independent study group?
What do you mean?
You said before you selected these 6 students specifically.
Mm-hmm.
What is your overall goal in this independent study?
With that group, I was selecting, well, partially I'm teaching that as an extra class that I'm not getting paid for technically. So my big goal was I needed to pick students I knew would be engaged in the project the whole way through. I also had them in a course and known that they were ready for this. Like, so they were all like second semester sophomores or older.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed to know they were ready for that kind of experience. You know, I was hoping mostly to spark something in them, you know, to see what they do. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, they started embracing the scientific method, you know, like as a method of journalistic inquiry. That made my heart sing, you know. you know, it was a goal I had in the back of my mind, but you never know as an educator whether that's going to happen or not. And sometimes it happens with students, sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they see it, sometimes they don't. You know, sometimes they get so bogged down in, oh my God, the sensor's not working, you know, and they lose sight of everything else that's going on. And I haven't really seen that with this group, which has been great. Because mm-hmm. we've had to duct tape this project together. I mean, like, we had to come with a backup to our backup. And that kind of flexibility is something that you really need from students. I wouldn't have recruited somebody who either wasn't interested in technology or I just didn't think was ready, like at a learning level or maturity mm-hmm. level or something like that. So those are, you know, that's the kinds of things I was looking for. And I've been really pleased to see the growth of them. You know, they may never try this again, but they learned how to bootstrap onto what they already know from journalistic knowledge. I think that was useful.
I mean, who knows? Maybe sensory journalism is the next big thing.
I think it'll be a piece of what we do. I don't, you know, I mean, like, I don't think newsrooms are going to ask you to build these. but what's going on in the background here is data journalism, right? I mean,
yeah.
Like, data journalism is going to become increasingly part of our future. And this to me has been, if I offered a class called Working with Data in Journalism, or like, quantitative methods of reporting, like, nobody would take that class, right? Like, I can get 6 students to sign up for this.
Yeah.
And I basically, as a backdoor, taught them how to do data journalism, quantitative analysis. You know, I mean, like, scientific method type stuff. I mean, yeah. If I offered a course in that, nobody would take it. So, like, that's going to be a huge part of our future. And these students have gotten firsthand training in that. Like,
yeah.
How to think like a scientist when they're gathering their data information. It's really useful. But, you know, I had to kind of be sneaky about it.
Overall, how do you hope to inspire students in their craft?
I want to inspire them to think, you know, for themselves and to investigate for themselves and to play. You know, I think that last one's really important, play. You know, just, again, I can offer stuff like this, but what I really want to teach them how to do is do that for themselves and to become curious. You know, like I said, I was doing digital stuff in the newsroom, but I was doing it on the side because I was interested in it, and no one ever taught me to do it. Nobody ever gave me permission to do it. Nobody told me I needed to do it. I figured out I needed to do this on my own, and I think that served me really well in my career. I think it still does, to be honest, because I don't consider myself the kind of person who, okay, well, I was an expert in social media when I graduated from grad school in 2009. I'm going to do that forever. Like, it's, you know, we're talking about doing virtual reality next fall. And we're talking about possibly pitching like a journalism futurism class down the road.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Like, we would just do like a
with the Oculus,
an immersive project in something, you know. And that would force he and I to reinvent ourselves every semester. I think it's useful that we do that. And so my teaching approach is about 2 things. First, it's about process. Like, you took Comp 30 with me. That's much mm-hmm. more of a lecture course, so that doesn't really count. But when I teach
yeah.
skills classes, some students like it, some don't. They don't get a ton of feedback from me because I really don't care what they produce. Like, I really don't. Like, and part of me is about, I certainly do critique like method, like, this didn't work here because of this. And I can teach like little things like that, but I don't want that to become the lesson. I want the lesson to become about, here's how you find your way in this. You know, like, about the process of learning how to do it, to me, is more interesting than, and I think more useful for them. So, A, I'm about process in skills classes. I want them to learn how to improve, and just learn, like, the daily habit of doing what they need to do. And so process is a big part of my teaching. But the other part of that is the curiosity piece. You know, it's just, you know, I can't teach that, unfortunately. Like, you're either curious or you're not. But I think it can be cultivated. Like, if somebody has that initial spark, you can teach them how to turn the curiosity into something that's self-directed, or teach them how to teach themselves, or to find the information themselves, like where you start a project if you have an idea. I want that second piece in there, you know, because I think that's, honestly, it's the only way I ever survived in the industry. I think it's the only way that I'll survive. I mean, media changes have been so crazy since I left the industry in 2004. You know, and Facebook didn't even exist then. If you think about that, like, it's completely changed the industry. Twitter was still 2 years away. The biggest social network at the time was MySpace. You know,
what about Blogger?
No, they weren't as big. No, MySpace was the biggest social network in the world. Blogger was growing, but I don't think they were ever even as big as Facebook in terms of users. They might have been in 2005.
Well, it's just people don't want to read paragraphs.
No, I think they do. It's just that blogs are like a mass distribution thing where like we have to have a lot of them, and then like a few readers for each one. And so like their interesting thing is scale, not huge amounts of readers for one blog, but like millions of readers for 100,000 blogs. You know, that to me is interesting, but it's different. It's fundamentally a different thing. So I mean, like social media, Facebook was a college network in 2005 when I first logged on. You know, so things have changed a lot. And now, you know, Facebook's making huge investments in things that they weren't even doing in 2005. You know, they're making investments in VR and worldwide internet and stuff like that. So I want to teach them how to be curious and then teach themselves and learn. Because ultimately, once they're done here, other than an occasional email hello, okay. I don't hear from them, and they have to kind of figure this thing out for themselves. And you know, the last thing you should be doing once you get out there is to stop learning, because somebody who's coming up behind you is always getting ready to eat your lunch. And your generation right now is pushing out some of the older players who stop wanting to learn. Well, you're all going to be that in 20 years.
You know? Yeah, I'm so nervous.
It's like it's the lion or the gazelle, right? I mean, like, are you chasing, or are you the hunter or the hunted? Mm-hmm. It's like right now you're all the hunters because you're learning the new stuff that the industry needs. But at some point, your skills become stale too if you don't figure out how to reinvent yourself. And I think learning how to reinvent yourself is a really critical life skill. And so that's why I'm about process, because it's like, you know, learning how to perfectly cut together a video is less interesting to me in terms of what we really need to be producing as students than it is about, like, teach yourself, like, how to tell a good story. You know, can you acquire the feel for that? Because then it'll translate across platforms. So, like, when I have students who are really good at video editing, you give them a VR camera. Like, you'll have some concept of how to do that right. Yeah, those are important. Those are the kinds of things that I want to accomplish in the long term. And that takes a kind of a maddening, I mean, like, students who come needing to know exactly how to succeed in my classes, good luck, because I don't really do that. Like, I don't, some professors of the department will, and that's fine, that's a valid teaching approach, but I just do not do that, because I want to set you free in some ways from the expectations that everything has to be perfect the first time you do it. And to do that, you almost have to teach you that failing is okay. Hmm. Maybe not in the great sense of the word, but in the product sense of the word. You know, like, it can have some major flaws and shortcomings, but did you learn something from that? Can you spot your own flaws and errors? You know, then that's, to me, a success.
Then how would you say your teaching style differs from others?
Like I said, I'm more about process. I mean, some of the students, it drives them crazy, I think. The sensor class has been interesting, because I told them to embrace the chaos of not knowing, and like to be completely stumped and to not know what the next step is. And I'm very much about that. I really love the chaos of a classroom like that. But I know some students are just into structure, like they need it. I'm not for them in some way, unless we bend to each other. I try to provide a little bit of structure when they need it, but I try not to go too overboard, and I'm upfront about that. You know, it's just that you need to learn how to be able to succeed in an unstructured environment, because, you know, fortunately, you're going to go out and work with people who don't provide structure all the time. I worked with some really, really disorganized people in my career. And being able to learn how to be a self-starter and a self-motivator and mostly a good self-critic, those are all important skills. So that's probably more my – I don't depend on – in my teaching approach, I don't depend on expertise. Other than my lecture class. But other than that, I don't fall back on the traditional professor model of knowledge transmission, where I know all this stuff and I'm going to infuse it into your brain now by just talking a lot. I depend instead on my expertise and, like, here's where the direction you kind of need to be going. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to help you get there. But this is a conversation, not a lecture. You know, it's something where you need to take charge of your own learning process in some degree. I have students who don't do that, and they do fine in my classes, but they don't do great. You know, the students who get the most out of my classes treat it as a conversation. You know, they it's something where they're getting help and feedback, and they're asking me about it. And you know, we make that kind of a semester long deal. And the students who really do that and embrace that tend to be the most successful ones, and they, by the way, get all the good jobs.
A direct correlation.
Well, correlation doesn't necessarily mean causation, but it's they get on good jobs. I mean, like they're more marketable. I mean, it stands out about them. They're more flexible. You know, they go above and beyond what I teach them, and it shows. You know, they're not doing the bare minimum.
You are listening to Prof Talks only on WLVR Bethlehem 91.3 FM. So I have this very important, I have this big fear of irrelevancy. How do I stay relevant in this ever-changing job market?
Keep learning. That's it. Never be satisfied with what you know and what you can do. I mean, get good at those things. Get good at your craft by all means, but don't operate as if that's the way things are always going to be. You know, so you need to keep evolving. And that means learning to be on the lookout for what's next, and being really smart to judge what trends are real and which ones are fake. You know, my funnest one to watch is always when there's a new social media app and every news organization jumps on it. That's the next big thing. It's just like, you know, because they've mistaken new for change. You know, and that's not always the case. So part of the literacy is being able to be smart enough about knowing where media is going, to be able to see something new and go, that's something I need to invest my time in. Versus something that's like, no, not worth my time, or something I need to keep an eye on, but I'm not entirely sure yet. Mm. And right now, that's Snapchat for me. That last one, like, I don't know if it's worth the investment yet. I see some of the other messaging apps as possibly being a little better in the long term, but you know, I know a lot of companies are diving in on Snapchat because that's where the kids are, and I just don't know if there's any return on investment yet. Like, I don't think anyone loves the New York Times because they're on Snapchat right now.
I don't know if people love New York Times at all.
Like your age group, I mean, you have a love read, don't worry. It's like,
I'm a Wall Street Journal guy myself.
Okay. So, yeah. Perfect. Yeah, I just don't know. It's interesting. It's useful. I think that the general trend of messaging is good. So like when I look at a situation like Snapchat and say, okay, messaging is probably something worth keeping an eye on, maybe taking strategic investments on, but Snapchat itself, So I think that those are, how you say relevant, is being able to be smart about that, because you can't invest your time in everything. You have a finite amount of time and a finite amount of resources, so mental and otherwise. So you know, learning how to pick up those opportunities and know what's real is important.
Yeah. So anything you'd like to add or anything you'd wish I didn't ask you?
No, not really. I basically told you basically my teaching philosophy and my approach. I mean, it's just... I think it's important for students to realize that, you know, their professors are increasingly at a disadvantage in a marketplace that where expertise is being destroyed. You know, we talked about the Comp 30. I am the priests of the printing press in a lot of ways, like the traditional university professor. And so professors have to evolve too. And I feel like I'm doing that. I feel like I represent a much different value proposition than mine did to me when I was in college, but I was depending on knowledge transition then. I was depending on expertise being transmitted to me. Fortunately, I didn't buy into that as the only way to learn, but if you are not a curious person, you are in the wrong class if you're in mine. Because I think I'm pretty demanding in that regard. I don't demand perfection, but I definitely demand a curious mind.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yep.
You've been listening to Prof Talk. To hear all the interviews and check out extended material, log on to our archives at wlvr.org.